everybody, Jimmy Dean, I'll call it. We can get rid of this resume paper. I'm glad to be here, and Maine has certainly treated me well. I've not been to the state of Maine before. You should be proud of where you're from. And thank you for letting all the New Hampshire people come over here, too. I have thoroughly enjoyed the weekend. I think most of you know, maybe almost all of you know by Saturday night, that there's something very special here. And that we have the accoutrements, the background of the mountains, we got the ski lift, we got the lodge, we got good food. All of that stuff is really secondary to what I've seen 2s, 3s, 5s, 7s, 10s, and 15s of you do since I got here on Thursday afternoon, which is, as Tom I would say, taking care of each other. We've been taking care of each other. My sponsor calls it pavement time. I believe in a whole lot of pavement time. The speakers that we've heard so far, just phenomenal talks. Your local vocal certainly doesn't have to be local anymore unless she just wants to be. And certainly the Friday night talk was an amazing talk. I find it interesting, though, that I'm from the Chicago group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas. And I may get to that, but I did notice on the program that I'm the only one that has an hour and 15-minute slot. And we all know that I'll talk slower than anybody else on this program this weekend. And I'm glad to be here. We give a sobriety date where I'm from. I'm sober since August the 25th of 1997. I'm thankful for that. And I'm a guy who certainly cleverly disguised as a functioning member of society because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not play well with others when I came to AA. And I took my first drink at 15, and now my last drink up and through now at 32, and for 17 years I tried to the best of my abilities to wrest satisfaction out of an alcoholic career. I didn't know how to control and enjoy at the same time. It's a problem. I don't know about all these lines sometimes we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Did we cross a line? Were we born alcoholic? Did we become alcoholic? Are we, recovered from alcoholism? Are we recovering from alcoholism? I think that in the scheme of things, it's all just, it complicates something that's really very simple. I believe in the definition of alcoholism that's given to us. Thank God Silkworth wrote what he wrote, that he was brave enough to put his neck out there, which is what he did at the time and place, and give somebody like me, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a definition of alcoholism that I could wrap my arms around. Because I had felt it, I knew it intimately. I had an intimate connection with that definition of alcoholism. I'm a guy who gets a sense of ease and comfort just driving to the liquor store because I know what's at the liquor store. I'm a guy who makes friends with those people that I patronize so they can open before 10 o'clock in the morning and stay open past 9 o'clock at night. I'm the guy who winds up in places with people that I shouldn't be. I'm a guy who wonders on Sunday morning what in the world happened the last day, sometimes two, prior. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and just spend time here. Nikki and I think are good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been a consummate host and friend and trusted servant of this area. One of the benefits of service in Alcoholics Anonymous is you meet a whole bunch of those people that they told me about when I was new. My sponsor talked about 3 o'clock in the morning people. And I said, how am I going to find those people? And he said, you don't have to listen to what they say, just watch what they do. These are people that answer their telephone without looking at the display because they've cleaned up the wreckage of their past. I had an interesting conversation with a man that he's dead now of alcoholism, but I sponsored him about three different helpings, and he was in a good run of sobriety. I got him to go to a newcomer meeting about 15 miles west of where he lived, and he was really picking up steam and really trying to take and apply the steps and really exhibiting some, I would say, some benefits of recovery in the program. And so my home group doesn't do it, but a lot of groups in Dallas will circulate a newcomer packet. Somebody identifies themselves as new to the program, and if it's a man, then men sign the packet. If it's a woman, women sign the packet. It's got various and sundry pieces of material in it. Used to be when we printed meeting directories, there'd be a printed meeting directory in there. And so Anthony had been putting his name per his sponsor's direction on every single one of those newcomer packets. My sponsor hosts a breakfast the second Saturday of every month. It's a book study, but we can't call it an AA meeting because you have to be invited to come. We're required to come, the men that he sponsors, and then we have opportunity to invite all the guys we sponsor and grand sponsor, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes we get 30 men in the kitchen, and sometimes we got 80 men in the kitchen. You just never know. And we cook breakfast together from 7 to 7:30. We eat together from 7:30 to 8. We study the book Alcoholics Anonymous from 8 to 9. They don't let me cook, but I'm a cleanup guy. I've been doing it for years, and I guess I need to stay close to this. So I was washing dishes with my pigeon, Anthony. And so I needed something from a guy who had left a little bit early and was on his way back to Dallas. And I said, I don't have my phone. You call that guy and ask him to text me or call me with the information that I wanted. And so here he rings this guy's telephone and gets his voicemail. And so about, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes later, I went out to the car and I got my phone. And when I called my guy, he picked up the telephone and he answered because he saw it was his sponsor calling on the display. And I read him the riot act. I said, how many newcomer packets do you think you've signed in the last 5 months? Not a single one of those men that got that newcomer packet from that group would ever have your telephone number in their cell phone. And you've not answered. You've indicated that you were willing to be responsible to the new man and then abrogated your responsibility absent any discussion. There was ever no formal communication to say, yeah, on Tuesday night I'm willing to sign up and be ready for this guy if this guy happens to want what we have. But yet if we roll around a Saturday morning, we all know that 99% of the people will never call us. But on the off chance that one of those guys actually gets brave enough to use one of those telephone numbers that's on that packet, I believe we have a first-person responsibility to answer. Absent that commitment, just don't put your name on the packet. If we're not willing to follow through, don't put your name on the packet. And I didn't believe any of that when I came. I'm a guy who told you I'd see you Saturday, but I didn't tell you which Saturday. And I began to learn that's not how we did things in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've already heard about those things. Committed meetings of AA. Actually showing up where we say we're going to show up when we say we're going to show up. I mean, it was not... I've had two sponsors since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first one, the first 2.5 years, brought me through the steps, really wove me into the fabric of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then this last guy's been, we've been together for 23 years. Now, they've been strong men in AA. They've given direction. But I've not one single time had a finger in my chest, but I've had an awful lot of arms around my shoulder. They believe that alcoholism is a life or death illness. I believe it too. I lived it. My first drunk at 15 was kind of a lame start to a life of alcoholism. I was a freshman in high school. I was a year younger than everybody else, and I was a nerd. I mean, it was bad. I had two friends. They were identical twins. We were a triumvirate of nerds roaming the halls of Woodrow Wilson High School in Dallas, and We heard about a senior beer bust, and I don't know what happened in your town or city if you were freshman nerds going to the senior beer bust, but we went and hid and watched them have it. They tapped that first keg, and they were happy, and they got in that second keg, and I mean, it was on. Boys have been chasing girls, and girls have been chasing boys, and by the time they got in that second keg, they were falling down on each other on purpose. And none of that stuff had happened in the French club, or the science club, or the Latin club, or any of that other kind of stuff. So my first conscious drink was two cups of hot foam from a tapped-out keg at the hill at White Rock Lake in Dallas, Texas. And it didn't change my perception, but I equated everything they were doing and all the fun that I knew that they were having with what they were imbibing. And there was a senior leader of that pack who found out that I had resources and they wanted to avail themselves of my resources. And so he gave me a list of three things that I could do, and his commitment to me was, we will teach you how to have a good time. First thing was, you had to be 18, drink legally in the state of Texas back there in the dark ages. And I don't know what you did in the state of Maine to become 18, but in Dallas, you went down on Greenville Avenue, you gave a nice old woman $50, and she made you 18. Second thing, you could have a hardship driver's license in Texas at the age of 15, and they didn't rotate your head sideways like they do now. I mean, it's almost impossible to have a fake ID anymore. Back then, it was just so much easier, but you got a regular, legit driver's license if you pass the test. And then they put a restriction on your license. So my restriction was to and from school only. And they put just a sticky tape on the back. So I went. I was proud of the fact that I'd been driving. We had a ranch south of Fort Worth. I'd been driving since I was a little kid. And I passed that test. And I was proud of that. And I went to that senior leader of the pack. And I showed him that driver's license. I said, I'm proud that I passed this test. But I'm not going to be able to drive at night. I mean, there's a restriction on that license. Now, he was a worldly guy. So he just flipped that license over and just ripped that sticky tape off the back of the license. I was appalled. I mean, I haven't started drinking yet. I'm a rule follower. I said, my God, man, you can't malign or defame that. It's issued by the state. There's a seal on it. He said, if it's midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, they run your driver's license, that cop's going to come back up to the window. He said, you make sure you look him square in the eyes. It's important to look him square in the eyes. He's going to say, Mr. Dean, you're not allowed to operate a motor vehicle on city streets of Dallas, Texas, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. You look at that cop and you say, officer, I had absolutely no idea there was a restriction on my driver's license. Again, it's information I can't process that information. I said, my God, if I did that, it'd be a lie. He said, if you lie to them and they believe it, it's no longer a lie. So the third and final thing I needed was a car to go with the license. I went home, threw a fit. I don't know, again, how what you did, get what you didn't deserve, but I threw a fit. And I had a brand new Firebird, had 14 miles on it when I drove it off the lot. Now, I got all the stuff they told me to get, but I'm not yet at a point where I think I'm going to have a good time. But I went to the Horseshoe at Woodrow the next morning, and junior girl saw the car. She didn't see the driver, but she saw the car. I was in the building about 45 seconds, and she found me. She gave me her address, told me to pick her up 7 o'clock that night. We went to a place called Papagayo Disco, uptown, Dallas, Texas. And oh my God, it's the fall of 1978. My life is about to change. They had trays of Amaretto Sours in that bar that night, probably 150 to 200 old people in there, you know, 25 or 30 years old. I was 15, I looked like I was about 8. She was 17, she'd had a couple of growth spurts, but she still wasn't legal, passing for legal, and they were $1.50. You throw $1.50 up on the barmaid's table and grab your drink. Who knows how many people availed themselves those beverages that night. I grabbed my first one and I drank it just as quick as I possibly could. And I'm going to tell you, Amaretto Sours are not going to be my liquor of choice. And it was like cough medicine with ice cubes in it. It's just terrible. I threw another $1.50 up there like everybody else and grabbed another drink. I don't know if it was the second or the third swallow. It happened. Where had it been? I found some guy like me make tomorrow seem like it's a million years away, and there's lots of times I need tomorrow to be a million years away. I found something allow me to repaint yesterday and make yesterday look exactly the way that I always wanted it to look. Where had that been? Where had that been? So I pursued the feeling, maybe not just that night. And I don't know, maybe the first 10 or 12 years that I drank, I would have told you that I only paid $1.50 per drink for those drinks that night, that first drunk. You and I know that's not true. I paid with bits and pieces of my character. I began to give away some of the things that had been given to me from the time that I was a little boy. I began to not be able to differentiate the true from the false. I began to intentionally not differentiate the true from the false. I began to cloud my situation and yours unknowingly. The last 4 or 5 years that I drank, I knew I was giving away all that stuff. I gave it away because I thought I had to. There was no other option. So if we talk about crossing lines, when did all that change? Was it the first time I went to jail? Was it the 10th time I went to jail? Was it the first time that I said something to somebody that I knew that I loved that I couldn't take back? Was it the 50th time that I did that? My parents, I didn't have when I was a young boy. My mother died when I was 8. She had a car wreck. She lived 8 days and didn't survive it. My dad had left us when I was about 4. I loved my father, my real father. I didn't have any reason not to love my real father. He was an amazing provider. He was just one of those guys that somehow he stopped off at somebody's address and he never came home. My mother was a very strong and independent person. If you think this accent is bad, she was from Metairie, Louisiana, which is almost in the water. Oh my gosh. She said coffee, it was a 9-syllable word. It took her about a minute and a half. Women in Dallas, Texas that she raised money with for all sorts of organizations and different kinds of stuff, they'd hear her talk. If she said more than 2 or 3 sentences, they'd say, "Where in the world are you from?" And she said, "Oh my God, I'm from Metairie, Louisiana. I only came to Dallas to go to school at SMU. I never expected to spend my life in the North." And to my mother, Dallas, Texas was the North. She had married again about 2 years before she passed away. A fine man who came into our lives. He was a stockbroker, excellent provider for us. And after about a year of marriage, they'd moved us from Dallas, Texas to Lafayette, Louisiana. She had kind of gone back to her people, and we had a good year down there. And I had left for Dallas for the summer. And she had a car wreck right after she dropped me off at the airport that morning. And we went back to Lafayette, you know, within 24 hours of information coming to us about all of that. You know, I was just a little 8-year-old boy. What did I know? They laid me in a waiting room in the front of that hospital, Our Lady of Lourdes in Lafayette, Louisiana. That old building's torn down now. And they walked down a hallway and go in her hospital room. And I'm sure I wasn't by myself for an extended period of time, but it certainly seemed like it was. And we didn't have any technology back then to pass the time. If you're in an old government building that got those acoustic tiles, those big square tiles with dots on the tiles, and I'd count the dots on the tiles just to pass the time. And I'd get to, I don't know, 100, 120, 130, and if I lost the number, I'd look down the hallway. If I looked down the hallway, somebody would come out of her hospital room, and I'd think they're coming to get me. Because if I hold her hand or whisper in her ear, I can fix it. I just knew that I could. About 8 or 9 days after we had started that process, and we were going every day from before the sun would come up in the morning until after the sun would go down at night, we'd get home and late at night. Nobody was talking. They sent a priest up the hall. He sat down next to me and gave me a little prayer card and said, "Think good thoughts about your mother." And that's the way they let me know that she had passed away. And the important part of that, as it relates to a story in Alcoholics Anonymous, relates to the directions in our book. Main object of our book, as I understand it, is to help a guy like me find a power greater than myself to solve my problem. She was the most God-fearing person I'd ever known. She got her cup filled in her building. We know a lot of people like that. I think one of the benefits of sobriety is I have a respect, admiration, and appreciation for people that do their service work in that community that I never possessed before I came here. But I was her only child. She thought it was important for her to take her little boy along with her whenever she did her service work. And I watched all of that. And after that disaster happened and she was taken away, as I understood it, the way that she was taken away, what I learned from that as a little boy that I brought with me at 32 when it came to AA was, don't you ever get too close to that power. Oh my gosh. It can destroy you. It'll destroy the lives of people around you that love you unconditionally. I watched it happen. My real father, for whatever reason, did not make himself known. My stepfather, his world, he was devastated. We had that ranch, as I mentioned earlier, south of Fort Worth. I moved in with my grandmother, his mother, and he went to the ranch. For the next year, he'd call on the weekends, ask me how school was going, if I'd hooked up with my old friends. And I wondered why he wasn't there, because he's my dad. I'm living with his mom. My grandmother was youngest of 9 children. There were 5 girls and 4 boys in that family, and they all lived ripe old ages, at least 90, every one of them. And those 5 girls, those sisters, talked to each other every day for 75 or 80 years. And I'd eavesdrop on our conversations, and she'd say, his heart is broken. He loved her so much. But we're going to leave him on that land because that land will give him strength. From the time he was a little boy, that land has always given him strength. And so what we did is we left him on that land. And 11 months after my mother died, our house was full of people. My stepfather committed suicide. I live and remember that ranch house, her only child. And at 9 years of age, I was angry. And that's an awkward process. And I've gone through it with men that I've sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous. But to a man or woman, over the next few days or weeks, I stuck as close as like glue to my grandmother's side, and people would part company with her, and before they would, it didn't matter where they were from or what they believed or didn't believe, they would say to a man or woman, God does not give you more than what you can handle. And I remember thinking, they're idiots. Those people are idiots. They're not going home with her at night. That big old house, every single light on all night long, and her laying there in the middle of the living room floor crying herself to sleep. That's not God. What in the world is that? So I brought all of that with me when I came to AA. It didn't make me alcoholic, but it made me extraordinarily adverse to the spiritual, quote unquote, part of the program. Which was one of the first hard conversations I had with a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, was how might someone like me, I believed I was above average intelligence, how would I be able to circumvent, at least for a window of time, the spiritual part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, well, you can't, because there's no other part. That's all we got. And he gave me a little snippet of something Dr. Bob had said. I think it was at the talk in Detroit. You know, Dr. Bob never said too much. He believed anything over 15 minutes was ego. And they had asked him what he thought had changed in the first fledgling years of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, we got a whole lot more activity, we got a whole lot less action, and we got better furniture. And that was all the material components that he felt like were accessories that Alcoholics Anonymous ever wanted or needed. So I got this real father that's living who's non-participating. I got this stepfather's mother who obviously loved my mother and loved me. And she said, I love this boy and I loved his mother and obviously my son loved them both. So she's the person that I brought with me when I came to AA. Every drunk in the room has at least one of them. They're the people that love us unconditionally. We heard about that illness this afternoon, one of the best Al-Anon talks I've heard in a long, long time. And she thought if she could pay for it or push it or prod it or change it, that certainly it would be different. For many years in active alcoholism, she believed it because I convinced her to believe it. When I got bonded out of jail after my second DWI at 30 years of age, I was half drunk when I called her lawyer to have him bond me out. I hadn't talked to her probably in a year because I hadn't had any hot checks that needed to get picked up or wrecked cars that needed to get fixed or any of that other kind of stuff, which is why you need a family member, right? You don't just call people to ask them how they're doing. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, a crazy man went to one of the nicest parts of my city and beat on her door until she came downstairs. When she opened her front door, she didn't recognize me. Alcoholism had changed me that much. But yet, to try to preserve what little dignity I had left for our family, she got me shuttled inside of her house and over on a couch in a side room. And about 7 or 8 o'clock, I got up and I'm ready to go because I'm sober enough. And she'd taken my keys, and I don't like it when you take my keys. So I start tearing up her house. And when she stands in front of me, a formidable woman, she was not a shrinking violet, kind of little white-haired woman, but nonetheless, she said, if I give you those car keys, you're going to kill somebody, yourself or somebody else. So I ripped a telephone cord out of the wall and told her I'd strangle her with the cord if she didn't give me the keys. When did that happen? When did it quit being fun? How did it turn on me like that? I didn't steal any of her stuff. I mean, I took plenty of her money indirectly. My sponsor had to tell me that that was stealing. I said, well, it's really kind of borrowing if it's a member of your family. He said, no, it's the worst form of stealing. You weren't even brave enough to steal from strangers. You just stole from people who knew and loved you. How do you make that right? How do you make that right? So I want to tell you just about one of my last drunks, and we're going to get in the good stuff. So I had 2 DWIs over about 9 years. I had I don't know how many public intoxications. 3 of those were in bars. It's hard to get a public intoxication in a bar. I'd held on to a job just barely that I'd gotten at the age of 19 when I was a sophomore at Southern Methodist University. It only took me 5 years to get out of that school, but I almost got kicked out for plagiarizing at the university in my first year, and my grandmother called a bunch of favors with some board members and kept me in that school, and I didn't say thank you for that until after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous many years later because I felt like she owed me. But, you know, life is getting more complicated, right? Alcoholism makes life complicated. So I'm a guy who drinks round the clock if it's even remotely possible. And so I do a lot of falling when I drink. So I lived in this furnished corporate apartment. Supposed to be maximum 6 months. I mean, everything provided. Silverware, towels, plates, cups, furniture, the whole shebang. And I'd been living there. I was in my second year. The woman would call me every 2 months and say, are you leaving anytime soon? And I'd put pictures up there when I'd first moved in. You know how you have 3 or 4, it may be like a frame poster or maybe some print or something, and you put them on the floor underneath the wall space where you know you're going to hang that, you know, kind of make the place temporarily your own. And those pictures had stayed on the floor for 2 years. And I was really down in the dumps one night. I was about halfway into a fifth of vodka. About 1 o'clock in the morning, I looked around and I had an epiphany. You don't have to be sober to have these epiphanies. And I thought, Jimmy, if you hang those pictures, your life will change. Situation's going to get better at work. Situation's going to get better at home. Personal relationship's going to improve. You just need to hang those pictures. So I took a couple of swigs of vodka, and I tried to figure out if I had any tools whatsoever in that furnished apartment. I had no toolkit. I mean, nothing. Do I have anything that helped me hang those pictures? And I finally found a big old butter knife that had a huge handle on the end of it. And I found an old Playtex glove so I could hold onto that blade. It wasn't a serrated blade. It was, like a butter blade. I could hold on to that, and I'm going to use that end of that knife for my hammer. I found an old wood nail in a drawer, and so I'm going to use that wood nail, and I'm going to hang that picture. So I got me down to about 3/4 done of that fifth, because you got 4 to 5 when you're going to do hard work like hanging that picture. And I held that nail with these two fingers right here, and I laid back. I'm about three quarters drunk. I'm ready to drive that nail, and I missed the nail. And I whacked the two knuckles on these two fingers just as hard as I possibly could. And, oh my gosh, right? I didn't worry about the fingers at that point in time. I just finished the vodka. Next morning, my hand was as big as my head, and I was a little worried. So I drove myself over to the Medical City Hospital, fine medical establishment in Dallas, Texas. I walked on my own steam into the emergency room, and I said, I seem to have done something to these fingers. And so they took me in the back, took some blood, and said, oh my gosh, the ER nurse said, you're going to need x-rays, and this, that, and the other. You've certainly broken those multiple places. And they took a little bit of blood, and she left, one person. Within 5 minutes, there were about 10 or 12 white coats all circling around me. How much do you drink? When do you drink? Why do you drink? Did you drive here on your own? You're 0.24. It's 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and they're talking to me about liver enzymes and white cells and red cells and X cells and Z cells. And I reminded them. I said, I came for the fingers. I just came to find out about the fingers. So they finally splinted me up. I had a big splint, and I had a big deal on my arm here so I wouldn't bend anything. And then they told me that I couldn't drive myself home, so I escaped. And I got on home, and I don't know, it was probably 2 or 3 days later, and I realized that the lip on my freezer had been, that seal was broken. It had been broken probably since the first 3 months that I'd moved into that joint. But I was on gin that night, and gin made me really concerned. And by the time I was about halfway through that fifth of gin, I knew that I was air conditioning the whole condominium complex, right? That cold air that I was paying for that's coming out of that freezer was seeping through the walls, and everybody was benefiting. I mean, it was all on me. And I was mad about it. And I opened and closed that freezer door about 100 times like I thought that was going to do anything. And then finally, I was so frustrated, I just came down on that end of that freezer with this right elbow. There's a little lip of steel in that freezer door, and it just shaved the end of that bone clean off. I mean, just cut it, just like if you just slice it. I didn't worry about it. I finished the gin. Next morning, I couldn't get my arm out of the bed. I wasn't going back to Medical City. I drove down south to Presbyterian Hospital. I went in there. They did the same kind of rock and roll that they'd done up there in Medical City and talked to me about accidents and how drunks have accidents and blah, 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 blah. And it ended up that they put me in a half a cast and had a big sling around my arm. And so I got this hand deactivated. I got this whole arm deactivated. And I had to get to work. The way I go to work is I get there about 10 or 10:30 in the morning, half drunk probably from the night before, and I try the best of my ability to sneak down that long hallway so those people that have known me ever since I was a kid at the age of 19 will not spot me. I just need to get into that office and pull those blinds and take that telephone off the hook and pull that trash can around because that yellow bile is going to start coming up. I know that it is, and I just need about an hour or two, and then, quote unquote, I can start to work. But you know what happens is I can't move down that hallway fast enough, and two or three of those people will get up, look me square in the eyes, and shut their office doors. They want to let me know how disgusted they are that there's anybody in that company that's got the guts to fire me. So I don't know how long I stayed, maybe 2 or 3 hours, and I'm starting to sober up. I got to go. I had a pint of bourbon under the front seat of my car, and back then I ended my drinking. I would shake so bad I couldn't even get the key in the ignition. And I finished about half of that pint of bourbon, got a little bit of a buzz, pretty healthy buzz, was able to fire the car up. It was hot in Dallas that day, kind of like this summer has been this year. I mean, it was terrible. And all of a sudden, I only lived about 6 miles from the office. About 3 miles in, I could feel it, the thunk, I had a flat tire. So I got deactivated hand, I got deactivated arm, I got the jack out okay, and I got the flat off, and trying to put that spare on those lug nuts, and it was just, to use a word called cattywampus up here, it was cattywampus. It just wouldn't mount on those lug nuts. And I mean, I hammered on it, and I pushed on it, and I pulled on it. And finally, again, level of frustration and a finished pint of bourbon made me think that it was a good idea to lay on the back of the car and kick it with my left ankle. I know. I missed the tire and I hit the rim. I heard them snap, crackle, pop. There's lots of bones in your foot. Anyway, I slung myself in the car. I went home and got as drunk as I've ever been. And the next day, I mean, my leg was as big as the bed. I wasn't going to Medical City, and I certainly wasn't going back to Presbyterian. So I drove all the way across town to the osteopathic hospital, and I hobbled into the osteopathic hospital, and they had to put me in a boot and a half cast, and oh man, it was a mess. So a guy that I was a fraternity brother with at Southern Methodist University, his life had gone good. We wouldn't have given two nickels for him to be a success at anything, and go figure. And he had married some high-profile girl from New York City, and they were living, you know, large. They were living the life. And they were coming through Dallas, and of course, I had to big dog it, right? He called me. I hadn't seen him in 20 years, and I said, well, come on down here, and I'll take you to dinner. I didn't have two nickels to rub together, nothing. The mansion on Turtle Creek was the nicest restaurant in the city of Dallas. Cost you $150 to valet park your car down there. And so they got there about 20 minutes before I got there, because I got to get drunk before I come to meet you. And here I am at the maitre d' station, and I'm going to tell you, it's about 27, 28 years ago, and I can still remember their faces when they looked up and saw the Frankenstein monster at the maitre d' station. I mean, my whole body was almost in a cast. And it took me all of 30 minutes and about three martinis that I couldn't pay for me to offend both of them. And I spent the rest of the, I don't know, till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning with some friends that I made new friends. Right? I would just make new friends. And I got so drunk that when I got home, I couldn't even get the key in my lock. But I finally aimed correctly, and I got that key turned, and I pushed too hard on that front door and slung myself in the living room. And I had a big iron coffee table then. Come on! This is AA. This is not some cotillion. This is a real deal. I fought that coffee table. I want every drunk to know I gave that coffee table everything I could possibly give it. I tossed with that damn thing, and it laid me out. And I don't know, 2 or 3 hours later, I couldn't see out of my left eye. Blood all over me. I thought, Jimmy, you've done it now. My God, there's not a woman in the city of Dallas look twice at a skinny 31-year-old one-eyed guy. If you think you put an eye out in my world, you need a drink. And I went to pick the pull off whatever I had in the pantry and went in there to inspect the damage. And I want you to know this is as good as it got right before I came to you. I had not put my eye out with that coffee table like I thought originally. I just split my head open so bad up here that the flap had fallen down over my eye. Now, I'd had pesky doctors for these fingers and more pesky doctors for this arm and another set of not even real osteopathic people for the leg. So I just held the two pieces of my head together and slapped a big piece of duct tape on there. Now, you got to be drunk to put duct tape on a wound that needed about 50 stitches. But you got to be wasted to get that duct tape off. My sponsor will promise you I came to AA with one eyebrow, and it didn't grow in the first year of my sobriety. But if you asked me if my life was unmanageable, I would have said, absolutely not. Absolutely. Memorial Day of 1997, I was about to be revoked probation, 2 years state jail revocation. My probation officer had a meeting with me, and she said, I could send you to an outpatient treatment facility, 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock, Monday through Friday. Treatment doesn't have anything to do with AA. But it's going to actually be the setup for my first interaction with you. So right before 6 o'clock on Memorial Day in 1997, I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Six or seven of us from that treatment center were marched like lemmings around the corner from that little medical center into a discussion meeting. Had about 70 or 80 people in it 25 years ago. It was much, much smaller now. I don't know about topic or substance of the discussion. Couldn't tell you about any of that at all. Nothing at all. We don't do poker chips in my part of the world. We do the recycled beer cans, right? So they offered a silver chip for 24-hour commitment to sobriety. I didn't want your commitment to sobriety. I was doing the math, and I thought, my God, if every one of these people talk in here, this thing will last all night long. So I popped up to get something to try to interrupt the madness. Now, I take that very seriously as a sober member of AA, and nobody in the room had any idea that there was not even a commitment that was behind the new man. They knew I was new, whether I got the chip or not. Then we closed the meeting. And it took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that my first interaction with you, I was interacting with what I call a meeting house. And that's okay. But it's a vastly different experience than being in a home group. They're just not the same thing. And I had to stay sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to appreciate that Alcoholics Anonymous did not need for me to in any way infringe on our fourth tradition by trying to say what is, quote unquote, a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and what's not a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I certainly had my time in the desert when it came to all of that. But here's what was crucial. The meeting closed, and a guy with 6 months of continuous sobriety held back. And because I had taken the silver chip, his sponsor had directed him to make sure he got the name and potentially the telephone number of the new man. And he followed that direction. And he shook my hand and he looked me square in the eyes and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He gave me his telephone number. I didn't give him any of my personal information. He didn't ask me if that was my first AA meeting, if it was my last AA meeting, if I was with the group from the treatment center. We didn't have any ancillary discussions about anything of substance that night except for my own well-being over the next 24-hour period. If you need anything, he said, use the telephone number. If you'll be at this same meeting tomorrow night, I will make a commitment to be here. And he saved my life. It was not my first day of continuous sobriety. I was a long way from that. Was not a place where the element of surrender had yet visited me in my own life. I was not in a position to want what you have yet. His journey was such that in my first 20 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, he may have had one stint where he had a year in 20 years of sobriety for me. I don't even begin to try to understand what that is. That's just the story. But the longer that I stay here, the more I know that the human person-to-person contact saved my life. Vitally important. And I bumped along for the next 20 or 30 days, dying of alcoholism. Now with the additional layer or burden of the treatment community. And they sent me out to a group that's going to be my first home group. I had no idea about a home group or what it meant. I mean, they just had some topic discussions in that deal every day. I mean, you know, nothing that really stuck to the wall and stayed. And so they studied the book on Thursday night. And that's the only reason I got sent out there, because they were studying the book Alcoholics Anonymous on Thursday night. And 6 o'clock for an 8 o'clock meeting, I met my first sponsor. I didn't even know he was going to be my first sponsor. He didn't appoint himself as such, but I can tell you, he certainly did. He interviewed me. I didn't know he was interviewing me that night. He didn't sit down with me and say, "I am going to interview you to see if you, you know, want what I have." He talked about AA. And when he talked about AA, I mean, you thought he was going to cut his suspenders and just fly straight up, right? He was as excited as any human being I have ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous, he talked about the things that we got to do and the places that we got to go and all the things that he had seen change. He had been sober 6 years continuously, which seemed like a million years at the time. And he said, he didn't tell me not to say anything in the meeting. He said, "Do you have a sobriety date?" I said, "No, I do not have a sobriety date. I've been drinking every day." It was the first time I'd told anybody that, because I knew I didn't want probation to know that I had not ceased consuming beverage alcohol. And he just kind of laughed and he said, "You're lying to your probation officer, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, she doesn't ask me every single time I go over there." And he said, "Will you just say I'm sober today?" And he said, "If you have experience with our topic, please feel free to share." Well, they were talking about the 11-step directions in the book. I didn't have any experience with any other topics. And so I listened to what those people had to say. And before I left that meeting that night with day zero of sobriety, that was a three legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous. They believed in the common welfare coming first. They were not ministering to me individually so they could try to, you know, prop me up. But I had my first commitment in AA. I got the assignment, put the signs out at that church on Thursday night to let people know that AA met inside the building. And then they had to put up the meeting and tear it back down again like my home group does now. So they had a set of commitments for people to do all the various and sundry jobs that were necessary in order to make that happen. Now, y'all know a little bit about subcommittees in Alcoholics Anonymous, committees and subcommittees, ad hoc committees, ham hock committees. And so we had the window shades, but we didn't have any place to hang them. They could not put them up on the walls of the church. So they had a subcommittee, and the subcommittee was to determine what to do with the window shades. And they had determined the best thing for them to do is frame the window shades. So a group of AA members with substantial amounts of sobriety had gone out to frame said window shades, steps, and traditions. They were like double oak frames, and they had bulletproof glass. I swear to you. When they went to pick them up, they weighed 78 pounds apiece. So they had to appoint another committee to determine what we would do now with non-portable, permanent steps and traditions framed, quote-unquote, appropriately, obviously to show our respect for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, right, these window shades, and they put dolly wheels on them. So they showed me how to wheel the dolly wheels in, and they spent about 15 minutes with me like I was the village idiot to tell me that the steps went on the right-hand side and the traditions went on the left-hand side, and all it looked like was it just had red and black writing on. I mean, who cares? I mean, I didn't know what any of that was. And about the second or third weekend, I want you to know I got them mixed up. And there were three or four people been sober since the earth cooled that were members of that group. And I was just sitting there relaxing because, you know, I had to get there 45 minutes before the meeting started to put those signs out. Now, I make coffee now. I show up 2 hours before the meeting starts to make coffee for 150 people. But back then, when I was not counting minutes of sobriety, I thought, oh, what an order, right? 45 minutes. And I was just sitting back there kind of resting on my laurels. What a good job you did, right? Setting all that stuff up. And I saw him in the back of the room. The little lady, I thought, she just kind of fell out a little bit. And the two old men just kind of propped her up. They held her up. She wouldn't come in. She wouldn't come any further in the room. And finally, one of the old-time men, he approached. And he came around and he looked. And he looked at the other one. And he looked and he looked. And then I saw my sponsor, big tall guy, looks like Larry Bird. He came in. He saw the problem. And he just ran over. And he immediately, you know, drugged these monster steps and traditions and swapped them back. And then I noticed color came back in the old timers' faces. They seemed to all be okay, and they all came in the room and continued their conversation. And he said, "Jimmy, my God, don't ever let that happen again." We almost lost 175 years of continuous sobriety. I filed that away for future reference, and I tell you that I did get sober in August, and I kept that commitment until I had about a year of sobriety. I kept it for a year, August to August. And there might have been two or three times in my first year of sobriety where those got mixed up, maybe just not necessarily on purpose, just to kind of see if people were paying any attention. And they paid attention. They paid attention. So a condition of that commitment was you had to stay sober continuously in order to keep a commitment. So from mid-June until the end of August, when I actually sobered up, threw in the towel and came into AA, every Thursday night, one of the members of the steering committee would go to the storage closet with me 45 minutes before the meeting started, walk out in the yard, so it was just the two of us. And the conversation would go something like this: Jimmy, I understand you've lost your commitment. It's the conscience of our group that we have to remove your commitment. And then it'd take them about 20 or 30 seconds, they'd spin on their heel and they'd give the commitment back. They honored the first tradition, the common welfare came first. But I wasn't in a home, I wasn't in a meeting house anymore, I was in a home group. I wasn't going to AA, those were people who were in AA, and those are two completely different things too. And so my sponsor was talking about his pigeon behind my back, and he said, I don't understand it, but the only sober breath that he draws, every Thursday he comes here physically sober and he puts out those signs, and they believed that they could try to encourage that sobriety by allowing me to continue to keep the commitment. We can make a roll of toilet paper of all the past things that Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me the opportunity to do. I was interim chair of the General Service Board, okay, through a kerfuffle. Through a series of events that created a position that would not normally have been available to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. First, it sounds lofty, first alcoholic chair of the General Service Board since 1938. Blah, blah, blah. The Al-Anon speaker's sponsor, I went to her 54th Al-Anon birthday. And my sponsor, Baxter, for the last 23 years, I was at that time the chair of the general, interim chair of the General Service Board. So my sponsor walks me over like he's got a new puppy to a table full of members of the Al-Anon family groups. And he says, I sponsor Jimmy, and Jimmy is the interim chair of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to make sure that his sponsee stays right-sized, he immediately followed it up by saying, if you ladies did not pray for Alcoholics Anonymous last night, please, please, please pray for Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. So how did I come to AA? Alcoholism. Alcoholism is a great way to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Superficial exposure to you didn't do a damn thing for me. But pavement time did. And when you told me, regardless of situation, that you were, God was doing for you what you could not do for yourself, it began to permeate every area of my life. You were consistent in your thoughts and actions. I realized that there was something happening that was not of you, but it was an integral part of who you had become. And I was sold. And I was driven to my knees by the disease of alcoholism on the night of the 24th of August. And from that day until this, I haven't even gotten close to finding it necessary to taking a drink. But they needed to continue to weave me into the fabric of AA. Because the drink is never the first thing that happens. Because it's about causes and conditions. The main object of our book is to help a guy like me find a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. But the book does not say that the problem is alcohol. The book says the problem is my reaction to life and how maladjusted a guy like me happens to be. So I'm at the top of the time. Lots of things that I didn't tell, but you know, all the men that I've been associated with since I've been sober in AA, and I've been to feed a lot of people, been sober a long, long time. Most of them now, because I'm 25 years in the deal, they're all in the big meeting. They're having a heck of a time up there in that big meeting. And they were never guys who ever put fingers in your chest, but they put a lot of arms around your shoulder. And they taught me really how to live like a sober AA member. And they'd say stuff like, if your program doesn't work at home, it's a sham. If your program isn't working where you're employed, it's probably not very good at all. And my sponsor had me read 1,000 times the directions in the 8th and the 9th step when they came to the passing all understanding about wives and mothers have had with alcoholics. And the facing page, which is the top of the paragraph, says, yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. And I talked to my sponsor in a lot of rides, a lot of windshield stuff in the first 6 months that I was sober. I was on, I don't know, step 1.2. And I got, you know, what thing about, are we willing to go to any lengths? What exactly does any lengths look like, right? What is that? So we parted company on a Saturday night. That was our open speaker meeting. We had 3 meetings a week, and that was what they called the showcase meeting, because it was the open AA meeting, speaker meeting. We'd gone to dinner at some place I didn't want to go, and I talked to Greg and commiserated with him about the sorry state of my life, and he knew a lot about that relationship or lack of relationship with that grandmother who made all those sacrifices and done all those things for me. And he knew about the telephone cord and all that other kind of mess. So he said, tomorrow's Sunday. I want you to call your grandmother tomorrow. And you continue to call her every Sunday until she tells you, do not call me. And I got in the car and I knew that was beyond any lengths. It was a place that I would not go. But I made a grave mistake. I'd been given some very simple things to do, things that I continue to do up and through today, up here in Maine with you, since I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those things was if I stayed sober all day, before I got in the bed at night, I was to hit my knees and thank God for a day of sobriety. Whether I thought the prayers went any higher than the ceiling or not, it didn't matter. And I didn't catch myself, and I took that action, and I got in bed, and I slept all night long. And the next morning, I took another action. It was a pattern that had been going on my first 50 days of continuous sobriety in the program. And before I did anything else, as soon as I rolled out of bed, I hit my knees, and I asked God for the opportunity to be of service that day and for a day of sobriety. And when I got up off of my knees, I couldn't think about anything but the phone. And the call that I swore that I would not make less than 24 hours before I made, with my sponsor's confidence, not with my own. And I followed a script that I'd been given. I asked her how she was doing, and I told her I was doing fine, and it lasted about 25 seconds, and there was no emotion in that call at all. And on Monday night, I saw my sponsor at a meeting, and he asked me how it went. And I told him about how horrible I thought that call was. And he said, did she tell you not to call again? And I said, no. And he said, you make sure you continue to call every Sunday until she gives you a direction that says, do not call. And for the next, I don't know, 70 or 80 days, I made those painful telephone calls every single Sunday. And I would retreat almost into a fetal position after I made that telephone call and could not wait until I talked to Greg so I could tell him about how wrong I thought all that was. And at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, I was on step 2.1. She picked up the telephone and she said, I've been thinking about you today. I made a batch of tuna salad. From the time you were a little boy, you loved my tuna salad. I have somewhere to be in 30 minutes. You can be at my house by 11:30. I'll make you a tuna salad sandwich. I hung that telephone up and I ran red lights in my town. I got to her house. And I sat at her breakfast room table with her back as straight as it had ever been. I said, yes, ma'am, when she asked me a question. I ate that tuna sandwich. It was like ambrosia that morning. 11:30, true to form, she kicked me to the curb. I didn't have a cell phone back then, 1997, 1998. I beelined back home, called Greg with the report. He answered the telephone, and I said, "Oh my God, she's changed." I said, "Jimmy, she has not changed, nor does she need to. She's beginning to see that you're exhibiting the natural byproducts of beginning to apply the principles that are embodied in the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no way that you can postpone or evade the natural sequence of events that will happen if you try to the best of your ability to implement these principles in all your affairs. There are four things that you will exhibit beyond question if you allow Alcoholics Anonymous to do what it has consistently always done. And those four character traits that I hope that you aspire to are accountability, availability, responsibility, and above all else, respectability. And I hope with my new friends in Maine that I have offered myself up to you as a 3 o'clock in the morning person. And if you're ever in Dallas, Texas, or anywhere around my region, and you feel like that you need an eyeball resource as a sober AA member, I hope that you will contact through Nikki or Spencer or one of these committee members, get in touch with me. Because Alcoholics Anonymous is a small and intimate place, and you have directly influenced my sobriety by allowing me the opportunity to just observe what you do for one another during the course of this weekend. And I owe you, and I'm thankful for that. And so I appreciate you listening. Thanks.